Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello, I'm Claire Armistead, and in this week's programme I'll be interviewing a diarist who is so famous that he has an asteroid and two trains named after him. I'll also be discussing the week's bumper crop of literary prizes with The Observer's Robert McCrum. And I'll be finding out what a group of very opinionated young critics make of the winner of this year's Guardian Children's Fiction Prize.
The book wasn't that great, but it was beautifully written, but the character was quite annoying at times and you couldn't really relate to her.
I like the book because it has an interesting plot.
He manages to keep the reader interested throughout the story.
It was a very emotional book, and on times it can be very sad, although there were the happy moments as well.
Students from Ellen Wilkinson School who came to The Guardian this week as a reward for winning the school section of our Young Critics Award. They'll be telling us more later in the programme. But first, our main interview this week is with an actor, writer, television presenter, comedian, president of the Royal Geographical Society, Python, asteroid, John Cleese's desert island luxury item, and as I said before, he even has his name on two trains. Oh, and I almost forgot, he has also published the second volume of his diaries. He is Michael Palin, and Halfway to Hollywood picks up from where his first volume of diaries, The Python Years, left off. So when he came into The Guardian earlier this week, I asked him why this particular period of his life deserved a book all of its own.
What I always thought of as a step in one particular direction, going from television acting and writing, which was what I did most of the 70s, Monty Python, Ripping Yarns, and then suddenly the great world of international movies opened up before me, and I thought this would be the future. And this period covers 1980, when I was writing Time Bandits with Terry Gilliam, up till 1988, when I just finished A Fish Called Wanda, the 10th film I think I'd made in that short period. And suddenly my life took a turn for the different. And I accepted a job going around the world in 80 days for the BBC. And the diary ends on the night before I leave, when I suddenly think, my gosh, you know, life's never going to be the same again. And it wasn't.
So there is a bit of a subtext of midlife crisis happening in this book, isn't there?
Oh, yes.
In a minor sort of way. You don't
I had midlife crisis from about 25 onwards, and still have it, but so it's a big midlife area. But yes, a lot of it is about doubts, fears, worries. Is this what I really want to do? How free am I to do what I want to do? Because Python we had a lot of freedom. We were free, really, to choose the subjects we wrote about, to write the content. Producers didn't really force us into doing one thing or another, and I wanted to try and preserve this outside of Python, which is a much more difficult thing to do.
And you did do a Monty Python film in that time, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, we did. I mean, Python was still going in 1980, and in fact quite buoyant, because Life of Brian had just gone out in America, and although it hadn't made a lot of money, it was a sort of success d'estime, and people were waiting for our next film. It's just that we took an awful long time to write it. When it eventually came out, it was called The Meaning of Life. Not the most successful of the Python films, but it has some great stuff.
Now, before that, you made The Missionary. And yes. I was wondering whether you would read a little bit from the opening day of The Missionary, which gives a sense, I think, of the downs as well as the ups.
I'd be very happy to. Well, this is Tuesday, March the 1st, 1983. To the City University, to be the guinea pig at one of Bob Jones's press conferences at the Department of Journalism. After an hour of this, drink with some of the tutors there. I'm listened to with far too much respect these days. I suppose it must have changed me somehow. I no longer have to look for an audience. They gather around me, even quite intelligent people, and wait for the oracle to utter. Home to anonymity and abuse from children. Thursday, March the 3rd. Missionary opening day. An equivocal review in the very influential Time Out, specifically criticising my role as being inadequate to support the film, is followed by a short but very negative piece in City Limits. In The Guardian, Derek Malcolm has me casting the paper aside in disgust and sitting head in hands in that deep, sudden desolation that only a bad crit can bring. But when I read him again, I realise it's quite a praiseworthy review, but rather obscurely written. Terry Jones rings and suggests squash and lunch, which I eagerly accept. Terry's been at Technicolor Labs doing last-minute work on The Meaning of Life print. It's now a time panic as bad as anything that happened on The Missionary. I'd forgotten about The Standard. Have a quick scan through Alexander Walker, and it's very good. For me and the film. A big photo, lead story, headline, mission accomplished. Phrases like, The Missionary is a very, very funny film. And a comprehensive relishing of the finer points of the movie, which almost makes the piece look like an extension of our own advertising. This puts a new spring in my step and a quite different complexion on the day. Drive into the West End, to the classic Haymarket. The acting manager, Ken Peacock, is in the bar. He's very pleased and reckons it could take £2,000 at the end of the day. The best Thursday for ages, he says. Up to the projection room to say hello. My handiwork slowly unwinds from the longest spool I've ever seen. Rather exciting seeing it all through the small windows. Friday, March the 4th. A rave review of Missionary in the Mirror and the Daily Mail and the Daily Express. I only come down to earth a little with the Times, but even that headlines its film column, Great Comic Acting, and only attacks the script for not being better. Helen returns with the Financial Times, which also says many positive things, but in the end wanted, quotes, a bit less caution, a little more anarchy, whereas Coleman in The New Statesman called The Missionary unfashionably well-written, which I don't understand, but like very much. Then after lunch, there's quite suddenly a great anticlimax. The film is out and running. The radio and television shows will be looking for new celebrities and different shows next week. At this very moment, I've nothing to do. No problem to solve, no crisis to defuse, no one to hustle. Just a grey, wet day coming to an end, and some writing which I can't settle down to. This evening, Helen and three of her badminton chums are going to see my film. I shall stay at home. Have supper with the boys, and feeling very weary, go to bed early.
So that's a sort of bit of a peeps moment, really, and so to bed.
Yes, yes. I like diaries that give you the morning, what's like when you wake up and when you go to bed. Very important, the sort of parameters of a day.
And after these very busy days, did you every night go up and write this diary?
No, I used to write the diary the next morning. I never wrote the diary at night because I was usually too incapable, either with joy, weariness, or drink.
Enjoyment.
Enjoyment, yes, yes, enjoyment, exactly. A glass of claret. No, but I actually felt it was important to wait a sort of 12-hour period, wait till the next morning, and then look back on it. It somehow sort of occasionally took the emotional sting out of a day, and you could write what I wanted to write, which was really a record of what had happened the day before, without the anger and the prejudice or whatever. I know that's a pity sometimes, but I mean, there were certainly feelings in the diary, but I felt it was much, much better to have an overview when you were actually clear-headed, like
emotion
in the morning.
Emotion recollected in tranquility, I think somebody once said.
That's very good, yes. I wish I'd said that.
During the later part of the decade, there's a sense of sort of gathering gloom, really. You didn't like, for example, A Fish Called Wanda when you first came across the script, did you?
Well, this is the remarkable thing about diaries. If you'd asked me, without the diary, what I thought of A Fish Called Wanda, I would say it's one of the best things I've done, thoroughly enjoyable experience, loved every minute of it. Only when you look at the diary do you find that things you wrote at that time, which don't have the benefit of hindsight, that was just a feeling. And one of them was that I thought The Fish Called Wanda script was rather hard and aggressive and ruthless and angry and not that funny. And of course, I that was before I saw the way Kevin Kline played Otto, which was just a marvellous performance where he's a horrible sort of psychopath who gets laughs. It's a brilliant, brilliant performance. So I've not changed my opinion of Wanda. It's just very interesting that the diary reveals there were doubts about the script and doing it. And I think I write in the diary, I'll have to tell John, this is one I'm doing, you know, for money rather than love.
So you say you're prepared to do work with John for money, but there's another little extract I wonder if you would read for us, yeah, in which you're very anxious about working for money and reluctant to.
Yes. This is 1987, and it's at the time of Wanda. Wanda was shot slightly later in 1987. This is March the 16th. And I'm in the throes of preparing the filming of Wanda. Monday, March the 16th, 1987. The script of the Bill Cosby film arrives. read it in the cab on the way to a Wanda get-together at the Meridiana restaurant. At least with Python, we had an eccentric, understated surrealism which kept things fresh and unpredictable. Here, the sledgehammer of zaniness has been wielded mercilessly. It's cruel, corny, clumsy stuff, and I feel that I'm not yet ready to do anything for money, even be Bill Cosby's butler, with some good lines. At the Meridiana are gathered Charlie Crichton, Roger Murray Leach, the art director, Greg Dark, Jonathan Benson, Sophie, John's assistant, Steve, and John Cleese. A pleasant group, and I begin to feel very warm towards this film, which up till now I've rather underestimated. The bungling incompetence of Troubles has increased my admiration for Wanda's single-minded efficiency. John makes much of the relaxed, wonderful, easy time we're going to have. Tuesday, March the 19th. Anne, my agent, has spoken to Michael Colgan and all seems set for an October the 5th start on the new improved Troubles. Only myself and Ian Richardson know this, according to Anne. Until I hear more, I can't be quite sure, but it's the best possible solution. Wednesday, March the 25th. I've been invited to an Author of the Year reception by Hatchards. The reception is on the top floor of New Zealand House, from which there's a fantastic panorama of London. I see Roald Dahl across the room with Jane Asher and Gerald Scarfe and realise I'm too shy to barge in there. I still have the mentality of an outsider looking in. I don't share their lifestyle. I don't easily have their apparent cool poise and urbanity. Well, not in these circles. They circulate because they know people will want to speak to them. Anyway, Bob Geldof brings me out of my shell, hailing me warmly. He's just come from doing a commercial for shaving, which he's rather pleased with. I hint at disapproval, and he snaps at the bait. My morality is absolutely clear. I just want to make lots and lots of money. Classic Cleesian position.
So now, this is a fat book, but presumably not nearly as fat as the actual diaries for this period. How did you? Is there anything that you censored in it?
No, you're right. The actual diaries are clinically obese, huge. So I think it's about 1.5 million words. There may be one or two things that I've deliberately kept out. It might just be a sort of judgment on somebody or a little piece of hearsay about someone that I know is around these days, and it will just look very, very nasty, and there's no point to it. The more painful things that I did decide to keep in, because I thought it was quite important, was all the sort of entries about my sister, who had very, very serious depression, and she commits suicide in 1987. And that was the most painful stuff to decide whether to keep in or not. But I felt it was rather important because I'm occasionally asked about my sister, and newspapers write something a little bit sensational, the private hell, the terrible torment, all this sort of stuff. It wasn't quite like that, so I thought I want to give my version. And best of all, it's through the diaries, and it was written at the time, and they're my feelings. And so I just asked the family whether they'd mind, and they said no. You know, those are feelings for your brother, for sister. There's nothing we want to censor there, and I'm very, very glad that I kept that in. So really, there's no guts of it that I've censored. Most of the cuts are sort of family holidays, long descriptions of me visiting Venice and things like that.
Is there anything that you feel embarrassed about somebody reading? I mean, you're famously nice, aren't you? And this is a cause of slight anxiety for you, I gather.
Well, it's just the use of the word nice, really, that I rather sort of groan at. No, I wouldn't have put anything in if I didn't feel that happy for people to read about it. It's quite a good sort of de-vanitizing process, because I realize there are a lot of things you do which are bodily problems. So you go to the doctor and have something stuck up your bottom and all that. And those things are not only important to you at the time, they're actually also quite funny. I mean, any medical condition, when I have my corn continually looked after by this man.
The corn's being scraped away.
I know. A man just didn't know what he was doing and had a cat walking through the surgery and all that. It was just strange. And, just the fact that when I have this strange black tube called a sigmoidoscope up my backside. And many people have this, and they have a little camera to see if there's any problem up there. And it was rather difficult. Someone's there, you know, you want to sort of break the ice a bit. Lovely day, beautiful wallpaper here. And so he had a sort of camera. He said, the camera will be there, you'll take lots of pictures, it'll all be over in a minute. And I said, do you do postcards? I thought that was quite funny, but it was absolute silence from the man. But I thought that was worthy putting in the diary. And I suppose a lot of people wouldn't put in visits to their body doctor, but we're all human, you know, it's kind of part of life. And I wanted the diary to be as honest as possible piece about my life.
Now, one last thing I wanted to ask you. You're famous for having made Machu Picchu into a, is that how you pronounce it? Into a tourist hotspot, aren't
you? I'm not sure.
You?
I think Machu Picchu will
Machu
do. Yes,
Picchu.
That will do fine, yeah.
And I was wondering if there was a sort of stampede of tourists towards it, you having recommended it as one of your favourite places.
Yes.
Would you recommend some books that you would recommend that people should read? And we'll see if we can create a stampede towards the bookshops.
Well, one of the most readable and sort of visceral travel books I've come across in a long while is Blood River by Tim Butcher, and its account of going down the Congo River. And the Congo is always one of those places, I think, where the horrors have fascinated authors, you know, from Conrad onwards. And I think it's the one place in the world where just tourists do not tend to go. So that should make it absolutely marvellous. And the book is appealing in one way because of the horror of what he sees, but he's also absolutely fascinated by it. So that's I thought that was great, and that sort of must be tourist proof. But you never know.
You never know. Yeah. So if we have sudden rush of tourism to the Congo, we'll know you heard it here first.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, Michael Palin, thank you very much for coming in, and I look forward to the third volume. Is there going to be a third volume?
I am contractually obliged to deliver a third volume. It's getting quite close to home, and I might have to have a think about whether it's just almost too close for comfort. I think 20 years like this, 25 years, 30 years, that's fine. If it's like yesterday, well, then you're in Alistair Campbell territory.
That was Michael Palin, and Halfway to Hollywood is just out from Weidenfeld and Nicholson. Now, this has been one of the most busy weeks for prizes that I can remember. On Tuesday, there was the Booker. On Wednesday, we had the Forward Poetry Prizes. And on Thursday, there was the Nobel Prize for Literature, which is always the prompt for literary editors all over London to sit around making fools of themselves on international radio, isn't it, Robert?
Absolutely right. I just had two calls from Sweden asking for my comments on Herta Muller, and I had to confess abjectly that I had never read a word she'd written, because actually only one of her books has been translated into English. And that's a commentary on our insular culture, I think, more than anything else. But it is pretty embarrassing.
Yes. That's Robert McCrum, who joins us to discuss this week's crop of prizes. Robert, what do we know about Herta Muller?
Well, I've been frantically searching the web to find out things. And all I knew before this morning was that she was a German writer of Romanian upbringing, and that she's fairly prolific in fiction and poetry and so forth. But I must confess, I hadn't read her, so I don't know much about her work.
Are there only two of her pieces, of her books, have been translated
I think
into English?
One in England and two in America, yes.
In America.
But this is a fraction of her huge output.
Yes. Well, it's a bit better than last year when Lecletio won. And
yes.
I spent the whole day phoning all around, the knowledgeable people I knew, and nobody had read any.
Our culture is very, very cut off from international trend, partly because we're an English language culture, so we don't feel the need to engage with translation.
Mm.
And that's one of the problems, I think.
Mm. I've got one little quote from Pete Ayrton, who runs the publisher Serpent's Tale, who published her book, The Passport, who said, Herta Muller is a writer who helps us understand what it is to be human in the 20th and 21st centuries. Now, does that make the Booker Prize look a little bit parochial?
Well, I think it does, yes. I think it does. I think the Booker Prize is a prize for the recession. And consciously or probably unconsciously, the judges have gone for what can only be described as box office. They've turned their back on the more difficult.
And the box office, of course, is Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall,
which is a Tudor spellbinder, you could say. Not to my taste personally, but those who love it. And it explores the life and times of Thomas Cromwell in the age of Henry VIII. You know, it's good stuff.
Historical revisionism, as well,
yeah,
isn't it? Because Thomas More, who's the man for all seasons, comes very badly out of it.
Yes, and and it's a rehabilitation of a man who's always been a bit of a demon.
Now, Robert Thomas and I have a bit of a disagreement about this, which is actually mirrored in our bloggers, Ariel321 and Dolkey, who are absolutely delighted, and others like Racine62, who preferred her non-fiction output. And there was quite a few who felt that J.M. Coetzee was robbed. What do you think of that?
Well, I think Coetzee, I mean, as Lucasta Miller, one of the judges, was saying to me on the evening of the prize itself, you know, he's a world class writer and a writer of one would imagine to have great reputation in the future, and he's already won it, but he's won it twice, so that's a bit of a problem, and no one has won it three times. This will happen, I think, at some point in the future, somebody will win it three times. Peter Carey's won it twice, the Booker that is, but I think Coetzee was robbed, I think, in a sense, and I think that Colin Tybee, whose novel Brooklyn I championed, was very badly overlooked. But as I say, I think the judges, for one reason or another, wanted to have a list which was, you know, a bunch of good reads. They were all very different. I mean, in some ways, quite hard to compare, actually. But to compare Sarah Waters to Hilary Mantel to Coetzee to the others is difficult. But they were all commercial. They're all very readable and very enjoyable. And I say that even though I didn't particularly like Wolf or Myself.
So now moving on to the other prize of the week, which has been rather eclipsed, actually. Poor old Forward Poetry Prizes. The main winner of that was Don Paterson. He's a Scot, incredibly distinguished, isn't he? Although a lot of readers will never have heard of him, but that is the lot of poetry these days.
No, he's been writing for many years, and he's part of the very interesting Faber stable of poets. And I think, you know, he thoroughly deserves the prize. I was quite surprised that they overlooked Sharon Owles, who I particularly like. But it's a very good prize. It has a very good track record, and its judgment on the whole is pretty true. So it's been a big week for prizes, no question. But prizes today are the way in which people hear about new writing. So whereas in the past the review was the thing which would generate the interest in the new writing, today it's the prize. But it's a very, very competitive market. So every little bit helps, I think.
And I think actually any of the books on any of these long lists or short lists, they're all good
they're
books,
all good
aren't
books.
They?
No, it's a great glut of good stuff.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, Robert. You can read full coverage of all the prizes and winners and have your say at guardian.co.uk/books. And check out our podcast interviews with Don Paterson and Hilary Mantel in the archive. Also this week, we awarded the Guardian's very own Children's Fiction Prize, which has been running since 1968 and has a distinguished roster of past winners, including Philip Pullman, Anne Fine and Jacqueline Wilson. For several years now, we've invited young critics to pen their own reviews of the shortlisted titles. So we invited some of them in to tell us what they thought about the books they reviewed.
My name is Aya Delphi and I read Solace of the Road by Sian O'Dowd. I thought the story was really well plotted out and really well written, but I couldn't really associate properly with the main character. At times, she was very sort of emotionally shallow and she wanted all materialistic things. And then at other times, she was thinking more in depth and you sort of started associating with her, and then she'd do something that you completely hated and was against, and then in the end it was just very confusing.
My name is Chantani and I reviewed the book Exposure by Moore Pete. I liked it because it tried to illustrate the contrast between races, and I liked the characters that were created in the book.
Hi, my name's Becky and I read the book Nation by Terry Pratchett. I really enjoyed it because it's got an interesting plot, and I like the creation story at the beginning because I found it really interesting.
I'm Katie and I did a book review of Then by Morris Gleitzman. Even if you thought that the story was going to end, there was always a more interesting twist. It was sad because it was a child, so I could relate to the child because it was about my age.
Those were some of the students from Ellen Wilkinson School who were the winners of our Young Critics Competition, which accompanies the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize. With me in the studio is Julia Eccleshare, who chaired the prize. Julia, what did you think of what the young critics had to say?
That was wonderful what the children said about the books. It is very reassuring when you discover that the books that the adult judges have chosen touch such a chord with the child readers. The adult judges chose a long list of eight, and out of that eight, they selected a short list of just four. So there was Siobhan Dowd's Solace of the Road, which is a wonderful kind of road movie, really, about a girl trying to find her mother and trying to get back to happiness and discovering on the way that happiness is much more elusive than that. There's Morris Gleitzman's astonishing book Then, which is his account of two children. It's an extraordinary child's eye view of the Holocaust, and it pulls absolutely no punches. And it's very hard writing for that age group about such tough material. And then there's Terry Pratchett's Nation, which is about what happens to a boy after the tsunami wipes out his whole world and he has to recreate a new society, but building on the knowledge he has of his past life. And finally on the shortlist, there was Malpete's Exposure, which is a extraordinary take on the Othello story, which weaves football, celebrity culture, racism, and the destruction, I'm sorry to say, of people by the media. And all four were very challenging books. I mean, the amazing thing about child readers is that they will take on these huge subjects absolutely eagerly, with no kind of reservation about what might be going on in them and how difficult they are. And of course, in a sense, if we think that one of the main reasons for reading fiction is to learn empathy, it's bound to be difficult material. That's where you get your best empathy. So those were the books that the judges thought were the four best of this year.
And then, of course, there has to be a winner, unfortunately.
Well, there does have to be a winner. And they chose their winner, and they were very clear about that. And the winner this year was Malpete's Exposure. Malpete, first book, Keeper, was shortlisted for the Guardian Prize in the year that it was published. So we're very excited to have him as a winner this year. It's the third in a trilogy. And we've been watching him get better and better. So this year is the year that we felt he actually had written the book of the year.
Thanks to Julia Eccleshare, Robert McCrum and the budding critics of Ellen Wilkinson School. Do feel free to leave comments on this week's programme on the podcast blog at guardian.co.uk/books. We'll be back next week with Robert Harris, who'll be discussing his new novel Lustrum, set in Rome. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead and the producer is Scott Corley. Goodbye.